Welcome to the Everything Coworking Podcast, where you learn what you need to know about how the world wants to work. And now your host, coworking space owner and trend expert, Jamie Russo.
Welcome to the Everything Coworking Podcast, episode number 62. Thank you for listening. I am really happy to have Benjamin Diet with me today. He has a really interesting background. He is one of the co-founders of Grind Spaces, which had five locations in New York and then in Chicago. And he is now a partner with Open Work Agency. He's been in the industry for a while and done some really interesting work, partnered with Verizon on a couple of his locations in New York, and then also is sort of the first one that I know of to do joint venture or risk sharing agreements with landlords, which is a really important strategy, I think, going forward. But he also is a real estate attorney by training. And so today I wanted to get his time to talk through his sort of best practices and watchouts for the lease signing process. And I know this probably doesn't sound like a super sexy topic, but I see it as such an important, crucial part of getting the model right. If you are new and have to sign a lease to do your first space, it is critical that you get that right. And there are so many pitfalls and places where you can go wrong, especially if you fall in love with a space and start ignoring some of the things that we want to avoid in order to have a lease that really supports your model. So we have kind of a long intro. Hang in there. We get to some really just nitty-gritty aspects of the lease and what you want to look out for and kind of options around managing some of the risk, how to work with a real estate attorney, that kind of thing. So I'm going to just jump right in, but I just want to make one quick announcement. If you're starting a shared workspace, I'm kicking off our very last 2017 cohort of our flight groups to help you avoid making all the mistakes you'd make by trying to do this by yourself. So I want to help you be more confident in your decisions, save time, save money, make the right lease signing decisions, and just enjoy the process more by not doing it all on your own. There's no reason to do it on your own anymore. So I only have one spot left in the group. It's filling up quickly. And we're going to start the first week in November, which is soon, once this airs. And then the next chance will be in February. So if you want to get in, make sure you send me a note now. If you want more info, text the phrase flight group to 44222, or just send me an email at Jamie, J-A-M-I-E, at everythingcoworking.com. We'd love to have you jump in. And if we're out of room, we'll save your name for February. Okay, let's dive in. Enjoy today's show.
Hello, everyone. I'm super excited to be here today with Benjamin Diet, who agreed to do an episode with me on everything you need to know about signing a lease. So I'm excited to connect, but before we get into that, some of you may be familiar with Benjamin. I kind of want to go through his background and what he's up to recently. He is kind of one of the founding members of the industry, so co-founder of Grind Coworking Spaces in New York and had a location in Chicago, founding member of the League of Extraordinary Coworking Spaces, now partner at Open Work Agency, and I'll let him kind of go through what they're working on there. And then in a previous life, long, long, long ago, he was a real estate attorney, which is why he's here today. And one thing he never mentions, which always blows my mind when I remember it, is that he also briefly owned a restaurant.
Well, that was a midlife crisis. I think it was better than a red convertible.
It probably wasn't. The red convertible probably would have been a lot cheaper.
Yeah, probably.
Yeah. So, Benjamin, thank you for joining me today. I appreciate you taking the time. So, give us kind of the brief Benjamin story.
Mm-hmm. Well, first, I want your audience to understand that I truly consider you a superhero.
Oh, we're in the case.
You have special co-working powers that you use for good and not evil. So in my eyes, that makes you a superhero.
Aw, thanks, Benjamin.
Oh, man, the dark days. You want me to talk about the dark days? Okay.
Dark, light, whatever you want to cover. But a little bit of Benjamin is.
Well, let me, I'll give it to you in a nutshell. Yeah, I was approaching the end of my college career. And one day my parents sat me down to talk to me about getting a job and starting a life. And I'm like, job? What are you talking about? I don't want a job. So I applied to law school.
Perfect.
I spent 3 years at NYU School of Law and graduated and went to a big firm, then transitioned to a small boutique real estate firm.
And all attorneys realized this was your calling and you loved it and you were thrilled to have found your passion.
Yeah, right. Yeah, that too. It's kind of finished off my more traditional side of my career at a huge international law firm, focusing on real estate and corporate work. Sort of towards the end of that road, I went to work for basically our biggest U.S. client. My firm was based in London at the time, which afforded me an opportunity to meet my wife, who I met in London and have been married to for 26 years. On the home front, I went to work for Alan Tishman at Tishman Management and Leasing, and I was in-house counsel there for a bunch of years. When I finished that road, had a very brief moment at another law firm, but it was clear that I did not want to be a partner in a law firm, and that is exactly what they wanted from me. So once I sort of had my epiphany, I sort of jumped and started a real estate investment firm with a partner of mine, which I ran for 8 years. Almost 8 years. We own mostly industrial properties in the Midwest and the Southwest. Unfortunately, we did not do sexy condos by the beach. We did steel warehouses. So much fun. But we sold those assets, that portfolio, out at the sort of what we considered the end of the line. That was 1999-2000. And I became an entrepreneur. I did a bunch of things that I wanted to do because I had some freedom. And one of them was opening a restaurant. Longtime dream of mine. And I had to get it out of my system. My wife, who is simply amazing, indulged me to the best of her ability. And at the end of a year of doing it, she was kind of like, the restaurant thing, I think you're done.
Yeah.
I proceeded to sort of start or get involved in a bunch of sort of early stage businesses after that. And lo and behold, I sort of got to a point where I was working like most entrepreneurs of that day, which was sort of the mid to late 1990s. I was working from home. I was working from coffee shops. I was working from friends' offices. I had the benefit of being a big firm, big New York City firm lawyer. So if I needed a conference room or an office, I had, 20 friends I could call. Mm-hmm. So I was a little better off than most. But what I did do was when I had a big project I was working on, I'd always rent a business center office for a few months to sort of get the work done. Yeah. And, one day I had rented an office and it was windowless at the end of some hallway in a nondescript business center in Midtown Manhattan. And every office was full, the carpets were threadbare, and the staff did not care at all about my business or what I was doing.
And your need for high-end coffee.
Sorry?
And your need for high-end coffee.
Yeah, and my need for high-end. Their coffee was awful. Luckily, I didn't drink coffee back then. You know, one day I went to them. I had some, you know, basic request, and I can't even remember what it was. But I do remember that they did not care. And I went back to my windowless office at the end of the hallway with the threadbare carpet. And I just said, you know what? I used to be a real estate guy. I used to build buildings. You know, in fact, I had built the building about 8 blocks from where I was sitting in the middle of Manhattan a number of years before that. And I said, this has got to be one of the worst experiences of my life. And I could build a better one. Mm-hmm. I mean, obviously there's something going on here because this horrible place is full.
Yeah.
And with a little design and a little hospitality thrown on top of, you know, this, there could be something here. And at the time, this was probably 2009. And at the time, I had never even heard of co-working, didn't know what it was like, didn't know what it was about. So that's the day Grind was born in my eyes. And so Grind was really born as a derivative of a horrible business center experience. It wasn't sort of designed as a step up from what then was kind of traditional basic co-working. I sat down with, you know, some friends of mine who I figured could help me, and I explained to them my need. I said, I need a workplace that is nice, you know, fairly high-end premium, where I could be with people who I can share expertise with and help them, and they can share their expertise with me and help my business, so that in a collaborative way, we can help each other be more productive. Mm-hmm. I mean, that was the basic brief. And we went from there, and, you know, we spent, you know, well over a year kind of figuring out the model. And I mean, we did at least approach it from the right sort of startup methods, which is design it first before you build it. And make sure that the user experience is correct. So we spent a year drafting a 100-page document about what Grind was going to be, look like, smell like, and what the customer's experience was going to be from the minute they walked in the door. And once we had that done, we moved to get it built. And we opened the first Grind in early 2011. And we went on to build 4 more for a total of 5 spaces before I parachuted out of Grind.
And you were an early partner with Verizon, which was also really innovative for the industry. So you've done, I feel like you've packed a lot into your co-working years so far.
Yeah, we did. You know, we built 5 spaces, I don't know, approaching 100,000 square feet. You know, at the time, back then, there wasn't really any effective management software for the industry back then. It was all tailored to business centers, and it was all about renting an office. And the original Grind had no offices. It was a completely open plan collaborative space with a couple of phone booths and a couple of conference rooms, and that was it. So, you know, using a management software that was about renting Office 102 to Bob Jones didn't work for us. So, you know, on top of trying to develop a real estate project, we had to develop a software project as well, which we did. So it was a very sort of complex but interesting journey.
So tell me, so you're not, you don't have an operating role at Grind, but you're with Open Work Agency. You're kind of like me, super passionate about the industry, and I would say have some of your own superhero powers and that you want to help others kind of navigate their way. So what are you working on with Open Work? Or you don't have to tell me specific projects, but in general, what do you do and kind of, you know, high level, what are you most interested that they're working on right now?
Well, Open Work has also been really a lot of fun because I feel like I'm getting the cream at this point because you know, as much as I loved grinding and loved operating, you know, you are locked into whatever model you're in. At least with open work, we get to move from project to project and deal with everything from more traditional retail co-working all the way up to full-on enterprise co-working inside of larger corporations. And we hit a bunch of points in between. You know, traditionally up to this point, we have been certainly working with existing co-working spaces on you know, expanding their model, working out their financial plans to move forward and grow. But we also have been working with real estate developers on how to include some sort of shared workspace in their projects, be them existing or new. And that's been really exciting for me because it does take me back to my early commercial real estate roots.
Yeah.
And the new frontier for us is working with, you know, large corporations on changing their internal workspaces, helping them create in-firm co-working, which is also really fun.
Yeah, and a great opportunity because not everyone's going to be able to do co-working. I mean, we hope that someday, but to give people kind of an analogous experience in their own walls is a great experience as well.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
So jumping kind of into your real estate expertise. So I've done a couple of episodes on helping folks through that process. I did one episode number 51 on working with a broker, episode number 53 on how to survive the lease negotiation process, which is a mysterious long process that most are not prepared for. And I wanted to do another one with an expert like you because I feel like I can't sort of go over this enough for folks that are looking for space and looking to sign a lease, because I think people are, you know, have a lack of experience in this area, lack of knowledge, but they're full of emotion and impatience and wanting to get a deal done. And I think this whole part of the process is, you know, risky and most prone to error in terms of running a successful business over time. There are a couple of other key parts that you don't want to mess up either, but the lease is just key. And so kind of getting this right. So I wanted to go through kind of from your perspective in order to, so I think we'll talk about kind of at the end, you know, a model of partnering with a landlord and avoiding lease signing. Cause I think you and I know at one point I love this quote. I quoted you, this was years ago, you saying, "I will never sign a lease again." And this was,
I think that was at the second Juicy. I said that.
Yeah. So it's like, you saw this path that most of us are like, "What are you talking about, Benjamin? That's just how this works." And now, you know, it's clear we see management contract models and joint ventures, and we can talk a little bit about that at the end. But I think for folks who are doing new spaces, it's harder to get those relationships with developers. So to establish yourself, you may need to sign a lease first out of the gate for a couple of locations to get started. So in terms of going at signing a lease, you know, what are kind of some of the best practices that you recommend people think about for that process?
Well, you know, when we started Grind, back in 2010, I couldn't even find a landlord in New York that would talk to us about mm-hmm. having the use in their building, let alone you know, partnering with us on something. I mean, we ended up with our first location because we knew the landlord, you know, from life in the real estate world and investing. And he was just willing to give us a break because he knew us. And I mean, it was a traditional lease. And, you know, because of our relationship with the landlord, the big break we got from him was he didn't, the security deposit that he required from us was, you know, minuscule as far as traditional standards were concerned. It's still a big number, but
I think markets like Manhattan and San Francisco, when I see those security deposit numbers, they sort of blow my mind. But what's kind of a standard security deposit expectation, maybe outside of Manhattan? Like, are we talking 2 months rent, 5 months rent, what should someone expect to have to put down?
Ooh, anywhere between 3 and 12 months.
Yeah.
It depends on the market, and every market's different.
Yeah, that's the other thing I would say is I run these flight groups to help new operators kind of get started and get through their first year. And whenever I talk to people about their lease terms, it's just so clear that things can really vary by market. But I think understanding sort of basic frameworks and ranges can be helpful. Yeah, smaller markets, people make it away with the month and, you know, that's easy. 12 months is a pretty significant, you know, loss of cash. Like, that's just gone.
Oh, and, someone trying to start a small co-working space. Yeah. I mean,
you
can't part with that money.
Yeah. So,
if we would have had to pay a full security deposit, we probably wouldn't have started the business.
If someone gives you kind of a reasonable security deposit that you can do, but you like, are there, so I've seen leases that negotiate a burn off. Are there sort of levers that you would recommend that people try to pull on their security deposits and getting those back sooner?
Well, let me start with the fact that we started with a fairly traditional lease because that's the only way we're getting started, but it was also the last traditional lease we signed. My years of being a commercial real estate lawyer, it taught me anything. It taught me that leases are not the tenant's friend.
Yeah.
The only thing they offer the tenant is term stability. But that's pretty much it.
Yeah.
Everything else is landlord weighted.
Yeah. And to sort of go macro for a second, this, I feel like people are probably starting to get stressed out at this point. your statement of like, right, these are totally tenant friendly leases. But again, on your first space, you probably have to sign one. And we do it so that our members don't have to, right? And that's part of the big value is these things are so hard and laborious and stressful. It's a major hurdle. And so once you get through it, you have a major benefit to offer your members and that they don't have to do it.
Exactly. And it does go against the basic rule of investing. One of the basic rules of investing is, you don't buy long and sell short,
right?
Which is what we're doing.
Right. Yeah.
But you mentioned levers before. Lever is important. Probably one of the most important levers is, if you end up putting up a security deposit, work out a burn off. You want that money back as soon as possible so you can invest it in your business because you're going to need it, going forward. That is a great tip. So thank you for bringing that up. The second big lever, revolves around the guarantee. You're going to be asked for a guarantee.
People ask me all the time, personal guarantee, do you do it, do you don't? And I'm always so careful. Like, that is a really personal decision because it's sometimes you'll have to say no to a lease, right? Because if the landlord won't give, you have to decide where you stand on it, and you have to be willing to walk away if they won't give on that personal guarantee. And personal guarantee, Benjamin, correct me, but I mean, it essentially means if you can't make rent, they're going after your personal assets.
Oh, absolutely.
Your house.
And but I at least with Grind, we had the benefit of starting in New York City, and New York City has a very long tradition of using what is called a good guy guarantee, and they call it different things in different markets. But what it means is that it's not a full personal guarantee. It's a guarantee that says, yeah, you're fully on the hook unless if you need to vacate and abandon the lease, as long as you do that and do it under certain conditions in a certain way and give us back the property so we can find another tenant, you're only on the hook up to the moment that you give it back to us.
Okay.
And that's a long standard item in New York City. Not so much in other places, but it exists.
Yeah.
Yeah, and while I signed a guarantee for our very first lease, it was a good guy guarantee.
Okay.
the leases, the four other transactions that we did after that, we did not sign any guarantees. So we, but we'll talk about how we move into the joint venture world.
Yeah. I mean, and there are landlords, or you can get to a point in your sort of credit situation where you don't sign them. I have the same thing, personal guarantee on the first lease, none on the second lease, and it's much easier to sleep with none on the second one. I mean, in terms of a personal guarantee, you sort of have to assess their risk. You know, what kind of assets does a landlord have? How quickly do you think they'd come after you when, you know, you come after your house when you can't pay the rent? What is the likelihood in the marketplace that you could sublease the space if the business is not working? And I think having, I don't know what New York looks like, but sublease clauses written well, so that you do have some sort of out if you need to get out, is also important. Do you have any comments on the sublease?
Yeah, the sublease clause is a tricky one because obviously the landlord is going to want to retain as much control as possible over that process, and at least the ability to sort of say yes or no in their discretion, which doesn't help you, the tenant.
Right.
You know, the second thing my first landlord did for us that was helpful, he gave us a very, very broad sublet clause. And those were the two things that they did to invest in our business, to help us get started. They gave us a minuscule security deposit, and they gave us a very broad sublet clause. And that was it. But that was enough.
Yeah. Because if you're in a good market and you can find someone to take your place. The other time, a sublet clause is important. So I sold my Chicago space, and that's essentially what I had to invoke. And Illinois has a law that says that the landlord basically has to approve the sublet unless there's some really clear reason to not do it. They could hold it up for a long time and make it painful, but there is sort of favorable to the tenant in that case. But you want to make sure you understand what that looks like. I think that's the piece about leases, is people get really focused on getting into the space and they don't think through the scenarios. And that's really what a legal agreement is for, right? Is thinking through, okay, how are we going to handle X if this happens, like such cause and the personal guarantee. And so you want to take the time to really think about, okay, what's the worst case scenario and what do these clauses mean for me if that happens? Or a best case scenario in a sale and you want to transition the business and but you want to think about all the implications.
That is such a critical piece of advice, because you always have to negotiate your exit in the beginning. And the perfect example of why is because, you know, once you sign a lease and you're humming along and everything's fine, how often do you look at the lease document? The answer is never.
Yeah.
And, you know, once you run into trouble, that's when you pull it out and start reading it again.
Right.
So you really need to plan for those times of trouble and situations where you need to exit or transition. And you have to do that up front, because it's too late to do it when it happens.
Yeah, and you're not in the mindset to do it up front, but you have to, because you don't want a bunch of, oh my God, what was I thinking, when something arises and you need to look at your lease. So on a related note, so you were a real estate attorney. Can you just talk about the process of engaging a real estate attorney for the lease signing process, when to do it, how to find one, and sort of what their role is?
Oh boy, when to do it. As soon as possible. When you start looking for property, you don't want to wait until you've found what you think is right, because, you know, whether you like it or not, you're already sort of talking about terms with the property owner. You know, during that process, you at least want to have someone to act as a sounding board for the discussion of those terms that do come up along the way. So when you decide that you want to move forward in this business and you want to go find a space, that's when you should go find a lawyer. And how do you find one? Oh, don't use your uncle or your cousin. but call your friends who have gone through the process themselves with their businesses and ask them about their lawyer and their experience with their lawyer. I mean, as you know, it's not going to sound like it makes a a lot of sensors are important, but you actually do want to have a personal connection relationship with people. You need to be able to work with someone closely, so you need to be able to get along with them. Yeah. You need to like them as human beings.
A lot of phone calls, emails, tough conversations.
Yeah.
Yeah. And from, not to pick on attorneys, but their mindset is going to be to find all the risks in the lease. And so that's their job, right? It's to identify the risk and try to engineer it out by putting in language that protects you. And this could make the process drag on for years. So the tricky part here, I think, is from a, like, to sort of know your business requirements and to keep those sort of front and center with the attorney and feel comfortable at some point saying, I'm going to take that risk, you know, or right, I'm not going to sign this lease unless we can get rid of that risk in the language. But you kind of have to know where you stand, and your attorney could sway you either way. So I sort of feel like they can help educate you, but also you have to sort of know for yourself where you fall on, will I accept a personal guarantee? You know, will, you know, lease length, and sublet terms, and all those things.
I mean, another way of saying that is you want to find a lawyer that's a deal maker, not a deal breaker. I've sat across the table plenty of times from lawyers who have a list of 100 things. If they don't get 100 of them,
right,
they're going to kill the deal.
Exactly. That's what I was getting at. You have to sort of be prepared to override that. Yeah.
And you want someone that knows what's important to you.
Yeah.
And everyone is different. And what's not important to you, or at least that what's not going to dramatically affect your business.
Yeah. Yeah. I like that. Do you want to find a deal maker that gets to know you and understands and will work on your behalf to get those things? Let's talk about lease length. So for folks that have never signed a lease before, I think their knee-jerk reaction is short as possible. If someone will give me a year, I'm taking it. If somebody give me 3 years, I'm taking it. And I
bad choice.
I want to make one quick point before I get your perspective, which is I had an email exchange with someone who was looking at a lease, and it was a 3-year lease and should do a lot of construction. So I just really quickly put together an Excel document that showed, you know, sort of payback. I was like, you can't even pay back your construction costs in 3 years. You cannot sign.
Oh, no, no.
And I think people don't, you know, sort of think about that equation, and it scares me.
Yeah, and let alone, you know, protection against the market swing.
Mm-hmm.
You know, when co-working became big, you know, my first lease was $30. And, you know, that space today is a $60 a square foot space.
Right.
That was my shortest lease, and that lease was 12 years. So,
yeah.
So anybody that's coming into the building now is paying $55, $60 a square
right.
foot. And
it would have been you if you had a renewal clause. If you had a renewal clause that said, you know, market rate adjustment after 3 years or 5 years, could put you out
yeah.
of business, right?
Yeah. I mean, granted, markets can go both ways, but
yeah.
you know,
yeah.
But the longer the better, in my opinion. You know, it's easier to figure out what to do with the remainder of your term
right.
on a lease than it
yeah.
is to find a new space and move your business.
Yeah, I mean, moving can cost a lot.
Oh, including costing goodwill.
Yeah, right. Totally right. Moving people around, not that easy.
And yeah. this is co-working. You know, half of the reason people are sitting in your space okay. is because your space is where it is. It's location.
I know,
if you move it 20 blocks away,
yeah.
they're going to be less interested in being there.
Exactly. And you may need to go get new members who are more, right, who, for whom that location is more convenient than your old location.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So, yeah, the longer the better. And so often you could see – I don't know how easy this is to negotiate, you know, 5-year renewal terms with a minor increase that's not market-based. I mean, is that common to see, or are you just signing up and committing to 10 to 12 years?
Well, inside of a 10 to 12 year lease, there are escalations, and that's where the rubber hits the road on negotiating the cost of the lease. You know, you start at one price, but you know, while you're getting protection against market swing, due to the length of the lease, the landlord's going to need protection against, you know, from the basics of CPI, basic cost of living increases, to which way the market goes. So that's a really key point in the negotiation point, negotiation of a lease, is what are the annual increases?
So hard because it's market-based, but what sort of a reasonable range for an annual increase?
Well, you got to start at CPI, which is roughly 3%. Okay. So I mean, if the landlord doesn't get that, they're actually agreeing to a rent reduction every year.
Right, makes sense.
Because their costs are going up by at least 3%.
Yeah.
So it's what amount above 3% are you going to agree to?
Yeah. So, and here's another point at which you need to do a pro forma, and you need to sort of, you know, forecast out your P&L, include the rent increases, and make assumptions about, in turn, what you need to pass through to your members, and is that reasonable, and does that look like it's possible in terms of passing along price increases and making you sure your model can absorb that over time. And on a related note, so the other big unpleasant surprise that I've had, same thing in Chicago, I signed at 20, I was in an up and coming market, and then 5 years later it was 30, and I had a good lease that allowed for, right, just, you know, percentage increases, not market adjustments, thank goodness. But what did it is, as that neighborhood got better and more attractive, is the building got reassessed. And so the taxes went up a lot. And that was passed through to me because my lease was written such that real estate taxes were CAM, and, you know, CAM gets allocated to the building. In the building, I was one, you know, I had a whole floor of a 3-floor building. So I absorbed a lot of that. Any comments on sort of CAM negotiations and
about that? Oh, sure. Well, the main thing is you can't avoid CAM. I mean, the landlord's not going to be responsible for increasing taxes. That's going to flow through to the tenants.
Oh,
however,
so that's not a you can't avoid that. Can you cap it?
Well, yeah.
Okay.
The thing is that when you come into a building in the beginning, the rent that you're being quoted basically takes into account the existing level of expenses on the building.
Yeah.
So. Unless it's completely broken out separately, it's kind of included in your number. So what you should be doing is you should be getting a sort of a base level of CAM, and you should be agreeing to pay increases in that base level of CAM over time.
A fixed or free for all, you know, building real estate taxes go up by $10,000 that's coming my way.
Well, for instance, in New York, and even in Chicago, CAM tends to be separated out separately. But what you should be agreeing to are the increases in those costs within certain parameters, you know. Real estate taxes usually have no caps because landlord has no control over that. That's a government function, and government tends to do what it wants sometimes. But when it comes to expenses of the building, you know, doorman, cleaning, repairs, the landlord does have more control over that. So you can usually get a landlord to agree to some sort of cap on that. You know, once again, there's going to be a floor on that is somewhere around CPI, and then there can be a top end, you know, of 5 or 6% per year. But, you know, the landlord's in control of those expenses to a great degree, so they're more apt to agree to some sort of parameters for those. But real estate taxes, once again, the government runs that, and they have no control.
So what's your perspective on, like, my situation signing up for a developing neighborhood that you think, oh, this is great because rent is affordable, but then you're at risk of absorbing taxes? I mean, do you just sort of weigh that and say, okay, I mean, I think you at least in the least want to model it out. I mean, it was not even on my radar screen. So I just remember so this is happening. And I was just floored.
Well, number one, this may, if you have a good lawyer, this may be a place where you can take some advice from him or her by showing them your business performance.
Yeah.
Because they may be able to point that out. And what they'll do is they'll suggest that you put in a very conservative increase number in your pro forma for that.
Yeah.
It may be exceeded anyway.
Right.
You know, make
some plan for it. Yeah.
Yeah. But you'll be a lot further down the road than you are by not planning for it. But it should be in everybody. You know, things don't remain the same. And that's where you have to start this exercise.
Right. Totally. And know that and make sure your model has some, your model cannot have no room to absorb the unexpected, because the unexpected will happen somewhere.
Exactly. And on top of all this, there should be a line, a contingency expense line in every pro forma.
Yeah.
You know, even you go super conservative on the numbers above that line,
yep.
And then you have that line in addition.
Yeah, that's good advice. So for you, I know you've only signed one lease, but for somebody who is going to sign a lease, are there any other, besides what we've already talked about, sort of deal breakers in terms of lease terms? Like, okay, I'm in love with this place, but I cannot sign this lease because it has this in it.
Really, the two main triggers we talked about, one is the guarantee situation, that's for sure. The security deposit is the second one. The third one, I'm also mentioning, but it's almost obvious, is the actual rent number.
Right. Right.
The reason it's a problem, it was less of a problem when I started back in 2010. Because
world had fallen apart and rents were all reasonable.
Yeah, there weren't that many co-working spaces.
Yeah.
You know, right now competition is everywhere and WeWork rules the world. So you are not in control of the pricing of your product.
Right.
WeWork is in control of that. So it is more critical than ever that you start with the lowest rent number possible. Because you can't control what you sell your goods for.
Or you have to have a product that is very, very different from WeWork so that you're competing differently.
Yes.
Yeah.
Exactly. We at least I feel that at Grind, we had that. We had a very sort of hands-on hospitality model that in a premium environment, and we were able to maintain higher prices. But it was a struggle. It was not easy. And, you know, so it's more critical than ever now that you really watch that rent number.
You know what I also didn't ask about is TI. Is there sort of an tenant improvement? We're using a lot of acronyms. I'll put sort of a glossary in the show notes for this, because I realize we're kind of throwing a lot of three-letter words around. Tenant improvement dollars, you can generally get some included in a lease negotiation. Is there kind of a typical rate per square foot one would expect?
No, that not only does it change from market to market, but it changes from development and building to building. Yeah. But even on top of that, it depends on the economy.
Yeah.
If you're in a market that has a 95%, you know, occupancy rate, you know, you're going to get less TI than you're going to get in a market that has a 70% occupancy rate.
Yeah, and TI is tenant improvement dollars.
Tenant improvement.
Yeah, the tenant is given by the landlord. I mean, given is a loose word because you're going to pay for it somewhere in the lease. But to do construction, to do improvements on the space, but it all has to be items that you don't take with you, like electrical, flooring, lighting.
And if you're dealing with a commercial real estate entity, this is tenant improvement dollars are built into their operating plan. But if you're dealing with a one building landlord, you might get 5 or 6 cents.
Okay. That's sad. Right, but also important in terms of, right, when you're choosing a space, if you, the state, you know, if you need 20 offices and the space is a big open shell and you have no tenant improvement dollars, that may not pencil because you have to pay for all of the construction, and construction of private spaces is expensive. And so you may need to keep looking until you find a space that looks closer to the state of what you need for your model.
Yeah. And also make no mistake that tenant improvement dollars are also factored into your rent.
Right, that's what I'm saying. somewhere. It is, there's no such thing as a free lunch from the landlord.
Yeah. So it may be a way to get a lower rent number, but it gives you the opportunity to fully control the build-out cost side of it.
Mm-hmm.
Because no TIs, and you'll start with a lower rent number.
Right. So it's a matter of sort of where the cash is coming out. Either the landlord's paying up front to do the construction, but charging you more in rent over time, or you get a lower rent number, but you have to front the construction costs.
Yes. Yeah. It's all about how you finance opening a space. That's what it's about. It's all about
that might be a whole separate episode. And Benjamin already promised me a separate episode on enterprise co-working. So look forward to that. And now I feel like we also might need a separate episode on joint ventures. So, I mean, just kind of for folks who are signing leases but have some hope of a different model at some point, what's sort of an overview of, you know, sort of what a management contract or a relationship with a landlord can look like?
Oh, on the joint venture side.
Yeah. And I don't want a few minutes because we're already on a lease. Yeah. It could be an entire separate episode, but high level.
It is, because it's a pretty wide spectrum. Even just in the life cycle of Grind, you know, we started with a traditional lease and we went to kind of a joint venture where the landlord agreed to foot the bill for you know, more TIs and no security deposit, but they really had no involvement in the business other than that. But you know, we were able to move into Class A office building without paying hundreds of thousands of dollars in a security deposit.
Right.
And then we ended up in a full-fledged joint venture where we had no lease. We had a management agreement. Landlord owned the space, built out the space. We operated it, and we split revenues. So, and there are 97 points in between those things.
Which is why we need a whole separate episode for this. But it's possible to get there, but would you agree you need some operating experience, possibly a brand behind you? You need to serve a story before you go to a landlord and try to do
that's the only way we were able to get those deals. I mean, our fifth space was our fifth space. We had four successful spaces before that that they were able to stop in and look at. And, you know, they saw the operation, liked it, and they're like, yes, I want this in my building. I will make this happen. But it starts with good planning and having a good pitch, having demonstrable evidence and information that you can share with the landlord to convince them that they're going to benefit from you being in the building, from everything from, you know, having a cool hip co-working space there, building awareness for the building, to growing future tenants for them inside your space. There are a whole host of benefits that you can pitch that will help convince them that they should take the risk in bringing you in as opposed to, you know, just renting the space to some traditional tenant somewhere. And, you know, obviously these arguments work better in softer markets than, you know, fully active markets. But
in $75 square foot space in San Francisco, for example.
Yeah.
Not sure that pitch is happening, but in other markets. Also, I'll just mention quickly, I was in Arlington Heights, Illinois, and Mara Hauser, who I interviewed, she might have been episode 50, is doing a management agreement with a residential developer. And so, you know, they've done their space, and I'll have to have an episode to just kind of talk about her agreement, but they funded all of the construction costs, which is amazing. You know, she made one thing she brought up. She said, you know, we moved in and a big miss we made was we needed blinds. She couldn't tell it during construction. There were literally desks that could not be used. And the blinds were like $30,000, you know? And so for an operator, that's like a bank loan, you know, it's a big deal. But the developer said, all right, we'll buy the blinds, you know, and they just moved on. So there can be really big advantages to that relationship. But she had to, you know, she came at it with a really successful location and a brand, and she, you know, has a professional background that was compelling to them. So, it can be done. And there are some exciting examples of that that are starting to pop up in the marketplace.
That's a great point. And I certainly had a similar experience with our fourth space where, we built it, realized that whatever was missing and this was wrong. And, you know, we luckily had a great partner landlord who said, okay, we'll fix it.
And when it's your own bank account, you're
yeah. But the point, the takeaway from all this is have those discussions up front. I mean, does it need to be a hard and fast paragraph in the management document or the joint venture document? Maybe not, but you don't want it to be a surprise either. You want your partner to know that this may happen. And if this does happen, we need to be flexible and figure out a path forward. So have those conversations up front, because I certainly didn't. like Mara, we lucked out. We had a great landlord who said, oh, yeah, that's not right. Okay, we'll fix it.
Yeah, right. Prepare and set expectations as much as possible, which is another good reason for running, you know, a couple of spaces, so you learn all of the things that can happen that you need to have in writing in advance. Anyway, okay, so you will be invited back to do more conversations. We'll both put in plugs. Benjamin's running a conference next week. I'll let him, well, this won't air. Your conference might be over before you air, but you know, we'll let you mention it. So it's brand building for next year, but Benjamin's going to join us for the GWA conference, the Global Workspace Association conference, November 9th and 10th in Brooklyn. He's going to be on our Ask the Expert panel. So if you've found him super compelling, buy a ticket to the conference. Benjamin, you're working on a conference next week. Give us a little overview of that one.
Yes. I am the program director of the Work Experience Summit, which I have partnered with the conference board to delve into this area of discussion. They haven't done sort of a workspace conference before. I mean, they do a couple hundred conferences a year. I mean, that's what they do. And so it's a little small, intimate conversation about work experience. We have some great speakers, everything from the HR workplace people from Citibank to Staples to Union Square Hospitality Group to really some fantastic, fantastic speakers. So, and WeWork is coming. The workplace strategy director from WeWork is one of my speakers next week. And we're doing it in New York City, Tuesday and Wednesday. You can go to the conference board's website to get more information.
Yeah, and I'll put a link in the show notes as well to both conferences. Again, it's next week, so this may not air before that's over, but you can put it on your calendar for next year. Keep your eyeballs or get on their mailing list so that you can keep a heads up on that. And Benjamin, I will also put your contact information in the show notes, but really quickly, where can folks learn more about you?
Oh, go to the Open Work website, which is openwork.agency.
Perfect. Yep.
And my email is easy. It's benjamin@openwork.agency.
Excellent. Benjamin, thank you so much for your time and sharing your story and your expertise today. Super helpful. Always so good to have an expert share perspective and help people make better decisions. So we really appreciate your time. Thank you.
Oh, Jamie, it's always a pleasure to do anything with you.
Awesome. And I can't wait to see you in New York soon.
All right. Yeah, we'll see you shortly.
thanks for joining us on this episode of Everything Coworking. Be sure to click the subscribe button so you can stay up to date on the latest trends and how-tos. Until next time.